I welcome you all back here to the second day of our SOTA postgraduate conference. And it's good to see so many faces that have lasted the distance and some new ones as well. A great pleasure in introducing Professor Ebtissam Al-Sadiq from King Saud University, who's going to give our second keynote. And as you can see, it's on Coleridge's Ballad of the Dark Lady. Professor Sadiq teaches at the University of King Saud, and she's here in this capacity of our joint supervisory arrangements that the School of Arts has with King Saud University, whereby their students come here and members of staff go there, so that it's a reciprocal exchanges between the two institutions. So far, we've been doing this for a year, haven't we?
Yeah, that's okay.
I think this is your second visit this year, and okay. Professor Sadiq came to last year's conference, and we have the two students, the two Hannahs and Bada as well, all from Saudi Arabia with us this morning. So it's great that this joint supervisory arrangement is working so well. So just to explain, Professor Sadiq is the supervisor in King Saud of the two Hannahs, Hannah Yan and Hannah Ayu, and me and Philippa and Sonia are their supervisors here. And so far, you know, it's been a very congenial arrangement.
Yes.
Professor Sadiq, I must say straight away, was the very first woman professor in the whole of Saudi Arabia. And she held that honorary distinction for 15 years. So it's quite an honour for us to have such a distinguished scholar visiting Northampton. She's published on the Brontes and on Salman Rushdie, on postmodernism and postcolonialism, and on Browning and Baxter. But this Baxter is an American poet,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah,
yes. Because there was a New Zealand poet called Baxter, but
yeah,
it's not the
yeah,
same
that's
one.
Not the Australian one, that's an American.
That's right,
yeah.
Yeah. And she's currently working on a full-length study of a British Victorian, I suppose you'd call him explorer, orientalist, cultural sort of traveller called Marmaduke Pickthall, about whom not a great deal is known, but who wrote a number of novels about being in Saudi and in Egypt, and who translated the Quran, is that right?
Yes, he was
into English. So a very interesting research topic. However, today she's going to talk about Coleridge, and I'm very much looking forward to your talk, so please welcome her.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Janet, for this introduction. The English Romantic poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge has left us several fragments, poems that were left incomplete. And scholars have explored the reasons why he left those poems unfinished. One famous poem was Kubla Khan, and scholars and critics did not find it difficult to pinpoint the problem, is that Coleridge was in a reverie under the influence of opium that he was taking as a medication. Then he was called to town on some business, and the reverie was interrupted. When he came back, the conception fell down, and of a 3,000 lines poem, he managed to write only 60. So that was taken care of in that way. Another poem, fascinating poem, Christabel, is also a fragment, and it has puzzled critics. It fascinated me in my early professional years, and I just kept hoping every time I hold the book that this version of romantic poetry has an ending to the poem. And some people went to explore why and found that it's because Coleridge has some kind of mother-son relationship that is a bit stable and it has affected the creation of Christabel. Some went as far as to even suggest an ending to the poem. The poem I'm dealing with today, The Ballad of the Dark Lady, is a fragment that was neglected. Critics did not see that much of significance in it. So I am trying really to figure out what is it that prevented Coleridge from finishing it, since there is no help from critics and no help from Coleridge. So I want. So my objective here is to find out why. So I called this the story Between the Lines. All right. So it's a fragment, and it has an interesting story between the lines, and it carries significant revelations about Coleridge's literary relationships with foreign cultures and elements. So I intend here to sort of divulge the hidden tale to throw light on Coleridge's engagement with the other in his literary experience, because that's my feeling what the poem is about. Since she is a dark lady, not the ordinary English woman. And of course, as I mentioned, in the absence of critical reference, what do? I sort of accessed critics' comments on other fragments to help me deal with this fragment. Also, I tried to use some biographical and cultural elements to employ and, you know, in the process in order to establish this hidden tale or divulge the hidden tale. I will also use allegory, although in modern literature or in modern criticism, critics are not looking at allegory as a favorable element, but with Coleridge, you know, it will work, because he has favored it except in his political writings. In the State Man's Manual, a political statement, he hated allegory and denounced it, because he wanted, when he talks about politics, to have a straight forward line. But when it comes to other spheres and literary writings, he encouraged allegory. So I also will make use of that. And ultimately, a post-colonial turn of the argument will bring things together. All right. The title of the poem informs of both the poem's form, which is a ballad, and its protagonist, a dark lady. Critics suggest that Coleridge's use of the ballad form in other poems, because, you know, my only, because since there is no direct reference to the poem, to the best of my knowledge, so I accessed his or critics' comment on other poems. So they said that the ballad indicates a kind of a desire to escape introspection and to locate poetry in public rather than private discourse. All right, because it's an objective form, contrary to what we see in romantic poetry of the I and the self as a focus of the poem. Here, the ballad is some kind of an attempt at objectivity in literary representation. But what kind of discourse is being objectified here in the ballad? This question hangs until we sort of investigate the other side of the title, or the other part of the title, The Dark Lady. Who is she? And in this case, we have options. We can either reference a possible Coleridgean invocation of Shakespeare's Dark Lady of the Sonnets and suggest that, you know, maybe, and we know very well that Coleridge did really lecture on Shakespeare in what critics nowadays consider as the beginnings of genuine literary criticism. Although Matthew Arnold was really to be called the father of modern literary criticism, but the beginnings actually with Coleridge reading of Shakespeare. So probably he read Shakespeare and was thinking of that, but we can also suggest an alternative. So without denying some critics' right to invoke Shakespeare, I would suggest in this case the Orient. After all, Coleridge wrote Kubla Khan, which is an Oriental poem. So my, you know, speculation is not really much out of the way. Coleridge's interest in Oriental tales is well known, is a well-known fact, not only from Kubla Khan, but from his biography. Some critics call it a fascination that reflects a larger cultural obsession of the Romantic period. So he is not only alone in this, but most of the Romantic poets demonstrated deep, not just interest, but fascination and some kind of identification with the Orient. Byron's stories is well known. Wordsworth to a limited extent, but it's a very positive image in the prelude of the, you know, of the Arabian Night. So it's almost always there. So he is part of a tradition, the Romantic tradition, that invokes the Orient for inspiration. And then critics say that it produced stories set in the Middle Ages, the Orient, or both. So this is my suggestion, this is my hypothesis, that the Dark Lady comes in as a result of an orientalized act of Coleridge's imagination, much in common with his surrounding culture. So he's not at odds with that romantic interest in the Orient. And here I said it's shown in Kubla Khan. But why is the ballad fragmented? Now, this is the original purpose of this study. Is Coleridge experiencing any inhibitions in his relationship with the Orient? And he told the story of the Dark Lady, the Oriental woman, and he couldn't finish it, therefore. Critics attribute the fragmentation of his poem Christabel. See, I said I have to access other fragmented poems, and critics' speculation on them to sort of look if they can fit in this poem and elucidate the problem here. So critics attribute the fragmentation of Christabel to the absence of the mother figure from the scene. But in this poem, the mother figure has a prominent presence in the Ballad of the Dark Lady. So what happened in Christabel, in this sense, does not apply to the Ballad of the Dark Lady. So here I begin really, or the story between the lines begin to emerge. First, the manifest text that everybody reads and sees and understands depicts a maid waiting in eagerness and silent pain for her betrothed knight who delayed his return and caused her to suffer and to be ridiculed by friends. When finally he appears, she passionately pleads to him, and she says, "Oh, give me shelter in thy breast." He responds in what seems, at first, a chivalric act of protection. This is, you know, the setting. When I use the word chivalric, we have to be aware that the whole thing is a medieval setting of castles and knights and courts and pages who go on missions. So he responds at first in what seems a very chivalric act of protection and promises to give her the fairest of his sire's 9 castles, but asks her to wait till nightfall. Then the two of them will steal beneath the twinkling stars to the statelier castle in the land. The maid detects an intended act of seduction and rejects his proposal. Why at night and steal? And, you know, the whole thing seemed so suspicious to her. She voices her dream of a legal marriage, complete with wedding ceremony. She told him, I want to marry you, or I want you to marry me, actually, in a wedding ceremony, complete with musicians and bridesmaids and flowers and everything. And all of this is the manifest story. We're still at the level of the obvious text and the manifest story. The knight does not respond to the maid's wish, and the narrator let go of the narrative line. So we don't know if the wedding is going to take place or not. The story is left fragmented, and the poem does not end. Now, reading between the lines, my own reading, finds that the dark maid is too eager in her reception of the knight. Clinging to his neck, she passionately exclaims, "My Henry, I gave thee much. I gave what I can never recall. I gave my heart, I gave my peace. Oh heaven, I gave thee all." That's what she tells him. Since the knight has actually pledged his sacred vow, proposed to her earlier, in the eye of noon, her perturbation seems unjustified. It intimates more than mere worry over a delayed return of or uncertain love. You know, if he had proposed to her and he was late, she need not panic. And if he actually proposed, he must be sincere in his love. So why is she panicking? And this is my suggestion. It's very likely that the knight has sexually taken advantage of the maid following his betrothal, and that she is devastated by the possibility of his abandoning her. His proposal of elopement supports such claim. I believe that the knight would not dare make such an offer had not a moral fall already been involved. Further reading between the lines would support this claim. Voicing her dream of a legitimate marriage, the maid asks the knight to lead her away from her mother's, not her father's, door. When the presence of the mother indicates security, that would preclude fragmentation of the tale, as Christabel's tale was fragmented, the absence of the father deserves investigation. Is the maid an orphan? Had the father simply passed away, would not another guardian have replaced him? And who is the mother that owns a castle? We realize in the poem she has a castle and can afford a medieval luxury of pages and serfs. I believe that the mother is a dark mistress of some lord that had managed to seduce, keep in a castle, and abandon later on together with her daughter. The maid's anxiety seems to arise out of concern at being condemned to her mother's fate. The dream of marriage is a rectifying act of the moral slip that compromised the maid's virtuous stance among friends, and a defense mechanism against the mistress position. What relevance does this submerged tale have to Coleridge interest in the Orient? Can we read the poem allegorically? And here I say Coleridge is not, because I have to go and look how does Coleridge feel about allegory? Would he be happy if we read the poem allegorically? And I found that Coleridge is not averse to allegory, except in his political writing, and this is the critic that I accessed. This fact permits an allegorical reading of the poem. The dark lady of the title stands for the 19th century interest in the Orient, a commonplace that Coleridge is aware of, meaning that this is like, he calls her the dark lady in the title, but inside the text he calls her the dark maid. So why this change? I felt that the dark lady of the title is not necessarily or exclusively the dark maid of the text, but she is symbolically stands for something general, the romantic, let's say, culture, interest in the Orient. So her story needs not be told. It doesn't talk about other poets' interest. Her daughter, the dark maid, is Coleridge's personal interest in that foreign culture. And it's here where he wants to voice that interest and look at it. In her story with the knight that the poet wishes to narrate, it is her story with the knight that the poet wishes to narrate. The relationship is described as one of sexual predation. If the knight has not seduced the maid yet, if you don't accept my earlier assumption, he definitely intends to do so through his offer of elopement. All right? So if allegorically, why is this misspelled? What a shame. If allegorically speaking, the knight is the poet, what does the Oriental maid rejection of his offer signify? So here we have the allegory. The knight is the poet in disguise, in this ballad. The maid is his Oriental imagination or fantasy. Why does she reject him? What does this signify? Okay. What does Coleridge mean by having the Oriental entity ask for domestication within the British culture? Notice here when she asks, if we accept that she is an Oriental woman, and this Oriental woman says, I don't want to be your mistress and elope with you. I want to marry you, or I want you to marry me. So this is like a quest for domestication within the culture, if we think of her as symbolic of the Orient. Is the Orient, now what is the significance here? Is the Orient defeating the poet's imaginative expectation of a wild, asocial, and exotic union by proving to be of a conventional type? Rather than being a mistress, she wants a conventional marriage. So is the Orient, refusing that wild fantasy which the English poet entertains in approaching the Orient? Or is the poet apprehensive that fascination with the Orient would entail evasion of social and moral responsibilities that he might have failed at and should now attend to? You know, there is always in Coleridge this feeling of guilt that the opium that he was taking as a medication was sapping out his energy and preventing him from really being fully committed to his social responsibility, especially as an author. Or is the practice now, here we come to more serious matter, is the practice of hegemonically appropriating the other morally erroneous and ought to be discontinued? These are like three possible interpretations. Now critics observe that Coleridge is paradoxically captivated by printed narratives of the unknown, though opposed to unregulated and irresponsible venturing into the unknown in the real world. Now, what is the meaning of this? Coleridge likes unknown realms of being, like to explore the Orient. But when it comes to the real world, he doesn't want that to impinge on his real world. If you have to live in the real world, some kind of realistic stream here, despite the fact that the imagination is fascinated with the unknown. That's Levy, a critic, who actually has a very interesting article comparing Coleridge to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And she finds affinity between the two. The statement indicates, anyway, we are with Coleridge here, indicates that Coleridge fears the impingement of the other on his own world. All right. The case of the maid in the ballad testifies to a different kind of concern. So even here, you access critics, but they open your eyes to some options, but ultimately, if you go and apply and analyze, you find that thing does not directly apply. The location of resistance in the maid, rather than the knight, suggests that Coleridge seems more concerned about the damage done to other cultures in such encounters than to himself or to his own world. I hope that you see my point here. It's very intricate. Had the knight rejected the maid's offer, then it would have been a different story. But the poet or the knight is not rejecting. It is the maid who does not want, really, to be, you know, to be appropriated into the culture as a misfit, but rather as a wife. So it is important that it's the Orient that is resisting, as if he is concerned about the damage when you appropriate the others. The maid's rejection of a mistress status attests to her refusal to be negatively stereotyped, appropriated, and enslaved for life, like her mother. The poet's imperial self, the knight in the poem, is held in check by the maid's act of resistance. If we say that, after all, that imagination of the poet and the attempt to sort of appropriate the Orient is in itself an imperialist act, then the maid's refusal is like the other is refusing to be appropriated and enslaved. The dream of the knight is held in check by the knight, by the maid's refusal. This reading finds support in critics who point out that Coleridge critiques geographical exploration because they lead to conquest and exploitation. So other critics have seen that in other poems, Coleridge hates geographical exploration because to him it is an act of exploitation of other cultures, as if he predicts the turn into imperialistic colonization that the Victorian culture later on developed, but not during the Romantics. But Coleridge was sort of sensitive to that possibility of geographical exploration will end in exploitation and enslavement. He was much opposed to slave trade and British imperialism. All right? He had, you know, there are proofs in other writings that critics pointed out. In this poem, Coleridge empowers the other to speak against illegal appropriation. He has empowered the maid to fight back and to reject the illicit or illegitimate relationship. He also allows a dream of an ideal cultural merging of the foreign and the local to emerge. This marriage that the maid dreams of, it's like somehow he hopes that there can be some kind of you know, merging of the Orient with the Western culture without one hegemonically appropriating or subverting the other. The maid dreams of a marriage bound with the knight, speaks of that. Oddly enough, he names the knight Lord Falkland. And here I begin another set of questions. Is Coleridge intimating that England is the land for all folks? Can the intimation be taken as a reflection of a genuine embracing of the other? Come to us, sort of. Or is it a sympathetic step towards cultural amalgamation? That's actually what has been said, so this is redundant. Or can it be an indication that such cultural fusion can only occur on the British Isles and is thus excluding the land of the other from having such privilege. If you see the point, Falkland, he's Lord Henry Falkland. So she or the Orient should come to the Englishman. So if there is any kind of cultural fusion, Coleridge would like to retain his British identity and have the other come. Okay, in an ideal union and merging, but not go and lose self and identity to the Orient or go there as perhaps Pickthall has done. The first two sets of speculation are more in tune with the maid's dream. All right, another set of questions. So which means that I favor the fact that he is intimating that England is the land where people should come. But nevertheless, there is this ideal union. Another set of questions. See, rather than closing the text, I am actually opening it, perhaps deconstructing my own argument, but opening the text for other interpretation. Because after all, this is an interpretation that can be negated. So another set of questions also arises in relationship to the knight's first name, Lord Henry. It's called Henry. Is it an invocation of Henry Wriothesley, the protagonist of Shakespeare's sonnets and of the love triangle with the great dramatist Dark Lady? This is like a new discovery, actually, about Shakespeare's sonnets. But who knows that at that time, Coleridge was aware of it because he was very much into Shakespeare's writings. Has Coleridge come across this fact before modern critical efforts reinstated names and relationships in Shakespeare's life, and he knew it all earlier, and is sort of hinting at it in the poem? Such speculation would turn the analysis in the direction of the Dark Lady of Shakespeare's sonnets, which this study decided to veer away from at the start. In brief, we construct meaning with full awareness of the deconstructive power of the text's potential for multiple interpretations. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this really fascinating, speculative, but wildly interesting paper. Many ideas here that are congenial to post-colonialists like myself about embracing the other and cultural amalgamation and so on. And many questions. I mean, you've asked questions, but they only serve the purpose of wanting to ask even more questions.
Yes, that's
so
good. No problem.
Has anyone got something they'd like to add to what Professor El-Sadiq has said? Or any comments?
Can I just ask a point of information? How much of the poem exists? You described it as being a fragment.
Yes.
But how many lines are there?
Around 60 lines.
That's
and the story that exists is just this woman in a romantic setting by a stream. She sent a page, her young boy, to the cliffs to look if there is any knight coming. And then he came, and she clung to him, and he said, wait until nightfall, and we'll steal and go to the best castle. And she said, no, Henry, no. And then, just as you proposed to me in the eye of noon, from my mother's door, come and pick me up with bridesmaids and flowers and music and complete wedding. And that's it. So we don't know if the marriage has taken place or not, if the knight agreed or objected, but it seems that to me that Coleridge sort of stunned and stopped there, as if he was considering this problem of bringing the Orient and amalgamating it into the culture. How legitimate is this? Would they accept that? All right, especially in a romantic context of a social, exotic fantasy. Is that he wanted to sort of ask, is that really genuine to the spirit of the Orient? Is that fair to them to do that? It seemed that this was at the back of his mind, what the others are doing with that, what the other romantic poets are doing in the culture. Is that right or not? He wasn't sure. And therefore, he gave voice, I believe, to the maid, and she said, no, it has to be legitimate. Okay. And then he stopped there, not able to conclude the poem with a yes or a no. Is it possible to have this marriage really on fair terms and complete domestication? Is it pleasant, after all, to the romantic imagination that doesn't want official marriage to take place, but rather have it as a fantasy? All right, so it's like all these questions, and I believe that's why the poem is a fragment, because it raises questions that Coleridge, with his sense of fairness, does not want or could not really conclude.
Can I follow that with another one other question? I'm trying to contextualize the whole thing.
Yeah.
Are there, how tightly constraining is the word ballad in the sense of expectation of structure? For example, you compare it with sonnet, and sonnet is probably the most constrained of all text types. But are there other ballads of that period which will give us an indication of what would be the expectation of perhaps length, but also structuring? I'm thinking in terms of narrative structure. You talk about the waiting. Is the waiting a necessary part in the structure of a ballad? And is there, a tragic ending expected in the form of the ballad? So it's a stylistic question.
Yeah.
I was going to add to that about and why it's fragmented parts too, because that choice of the ballad,
yeah,
a very kind of traditional, long-standing British form, as it were, is this around the time when Walter Scott writing his Border Ballads as well? You know, it must be around this time, Coleridge was surely aware of this. And this kind of quintessentially English form somehow, or UK form, and then this Oriental subject matter. And I wonder in a way whether he couldn't quite make, you know, like he's almost trying to merge an exotic subject matter with a much more traditional, structured, standard form, and that there's a tension there, that it almost wasn't working perhaps.
Yeah, could be. That could be, I believe, another reading. But we ought to be aware also that the ballad form has evolved with the Romantics, with Coleridge and Wordsworth. Immediately they say the lyrical ballad.
Yes.
All right? They have it as a lyrical ballad. So it's not that earlier purely objective narrational form. It has become lyrical. And when you speak of a lyric poem, it's a very subjective voicing of emotions and experience. So my suspicion is that this is one of the lyrical ballads. But it's like Coleridge is sort of disguising this conflict in that form, you know, that emotional, you know, fascination that is held in check by perhaps a sense of fairness or a sense of where is this amalgamation to be taking place? In the culture, which is not fair to the other, or in the other culture, which is perhaps threatening to identity.
Louise.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was really, really interesting. I just wondered whether I was quite interested when you said that in the poem itself, I haven't read the poem, so
yeah.
In the poem itself, he refers to her as the maid, but the title of the poem is Dark Lady.
Yes.
And I just wonder whether you can relate his ambivalence about allowing this Oriental marriage to take place. If he calls the title of the poem Dark Lady, that would imply a woman who's married to a lord. So the word lady is the lord's wife.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether he's actually giving you the ending there,
mm-hmm,
by telling you, before you even start reading the poem, that she does in fact marry him, but he doesn't articulate that in the poem itself.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to express that. He wants,
mm-hmm,
to leave the reader to guess.
Yeah, that's a very nice insight. Could be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in my speculation, I felt that the Orient has become almost a tradition established in the culture through other poets like Wordsworth, who is of an older generation, through Byron, who was much immersed into the Orient than any of the other romantics. It could be. So it's already a tradition that is established. This is how I took it, that she's a lady. But then out of that, he has this small portion, his love relationship with the Orient, which is the maid. So,
I wonder if there's been any source study done on the poem, because it sounds, if it's a ballad, you know, quite often they do float around in the culture and different formats and tropes exist, and he may well be drawing on not just the Shakespearean allusion to the Dark Lady, but to some other sort of folk story in which, you know, those terms are yoked together. And also whether there has been any attempt to identify Lord Falkland as a real person. Is there a biographical or historical personage with that name from Coleridge's own era?
Yeah. Okay. The first part, I haven't found any studies on the Dark Lady. That's why I have to access other critics' commentary on other fragments, but nothing on the Dark Lady. I have, nothing at all. Critics did not really care to investigate it. It's because, I don't know. But for me, the Dark Lady sort of, you know, captured my interest. Also, the other part is the Shakespeare part. There is a study that I found on the internet of a new discovery of this love triangle, but not in relationship to the Dark Lady of Coleridge. It's the relationship to Shakespeare's Dark Lady.
Yes.
The recent study says that there is a love triangle in which the Dark Lady and Shakespeare and a friend were sort involved in love with this woman, and the other person is called Henry Wriothesley or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Yes?
In terms of sources, I was really reminded of a lot of Gothic fragment narratives that were very popular towards the end of the 18th century. And in Chris Baldick has got an edited collection called Gothic Tales, the Oxford Book of Gothic Tales.
Yes.
And in the 18th century section there were two. There's one called Sir Bertrand, a fragment, where he comes across a lady in a castle at night who is, he has to get to, and she comes awake, and she's about to start telling him a story, and then it breaks off. But the other one in particular is, I think there's a story in there called The Ruins of the Abbey of Fitzmartin, and there's a story told through fragmentation, through a manuscript of a woman who is kind of seduced by a man at night into eloping. I think they do actually get married, but then she finds herself pregnant and she goes into a convent waiting for him to come back and claim her. He says he'll take her to his father's castle.
Mm-hmm.
And he never comes back.
Yes.
And there's a kind of evil baron sort of there. And those two stories, but I was thinking of them all the time you read that. We know Coleridge liked the Gothic. I mean, he commented on movies as a monk and wrote about fragments. So I just wonder how much he might have read some, because the Gothic, you know, really espoused the fragment of the literary form, didn't it, very consciously, and whether or not there's some kind of influence there almost. In certainly the narrative idea, and of the fragment, but also some of the subject matter too.
Yeah, it could be. I don't say no to that exactly, but we notice here that mostly it's an outdoor kind of thing. The whole poem takes place outside in nature. All right, the woman is sitting by the stream. She never goes indoor, and she sends the page on the same mountaintop, where the castle is, the stream is, and the cliff is, and he looks. So to me, it didn't have really that creepy atmosphere, except if it happened outside the poem.
Yes, in the
if it happened outside, could be. Yeah,
yeah. The Ruins of David Fitzmartin, all the kind of illicit liaison, the only time the kind of maid ever sees the lover in the garden of the abbey is when she's out of the abbey itself, and she, her father is absent. And this kind of wild space, he comes to her sort of in the garden, on the outskirts of the forest.
Yeah.
So there is that outdoor, and that's very particular.
Yeah.
Maybe just wonder for the culture.
Yeah, and if we apply this form, then we will say, okay, for sure, for the first suggestion that he might have seduced her, and that's why she is so panicky, so to speak.
Yes.
But if not, then after all, he says, let's elope. It's right there, pronounced.
Yes.
So either think the damage has been done earlier or it's about to happen. Both cases, he's looking at this relationship between the English knight and the dark lady as one of sexual predation.
Yeah.
And that's what he hates about it.
Well,
I
this
think.
Is certainly what happens in that story too, because she, her father wants her to, he's arranging a marriage for her. She thinks that she's already really married to this person.
Yeah.
They've consummated
yeah.
it. She's put in a convent to wait, and she knows she's pregnant, and she just waits. She knows that everyone's going to realise before long. So she's desperate for him to come before it's too late and her honour can be saved, but he never comes back. So.
But the setting, of course, the medieval setting, which would justify this fear of possible seduction or a seduction that has taken place.
Yes.
Perhaps in modern times it might not seem so outrageous, but at that time, the whole setting suggests that it wasn't morally appropriate. And she tells him, my friends are making fun of me. Why? Over what? So possibly there was some kind of jeopardizing of, you know, of her virtue.
Do we know why he broke off? Was there any person from Porlock there at the door that made him stop? Or can we say that Coleridge reached an impasse in his dealing with the sort of morality of the situation, as you've described so well, and didn't really know where to go next, and thought, I'll finish it tomorrow or the next day or when I next take opium, and just abandoned it.
Yes, there is, I think, the lyrical balance. It was supposed to be, wasn't it, a 50-50 split, but it ended up being maybe worse, and Coleridge managed to get a few things in.
I think that was supposed to be a joint thing, but
he just shoves in a couple of things, Coleridge, and in the end it's mainly Wordsworth's poem, because Coleridge just couldn't fulfill the end of the deal by writing things.
So is your question, Janet, about
well,
the story taken literally or read allegorically?
I would think, reading it allegorically, that that Coleridge reached a point of where he felt he couldn't go on, and that's why he stopped. Or was there an external reason? Do we know that there was an external reason for the poem to break off at that point?
Yeah, he would have told us.
He would have, okay.
Because he told us in Kubla Khan.
Okay, so we...
He said that it was a dream of...
Yeah.
A 3,000 lines, and it ended up as 60 lines.
Yes.
And he was just cursing that mission that drove him away to town.
But maybe, you know, that probably happened, but if what you say is true, then it was a convenient excuse, actually.
I think it was a non-finished poem.
And this is another example where there isn't a person from Porlock, there isn't an external knock on the door.
Yeah.
Or, going back to the point, is he espousing the whole Gothic idea of the fragment, where people actually wrote, artificially constructed a fragment, as if it had been discovered, but you know, really it was very contrived. So is there an artificial contrivance to it as a fragment? Because it retains its enigma then, doesn't it, too?
Yeah. But if I managed to sort of, you know, inspire another reading, that would be great.
Yes.
Because I'm not really closing the text to other interpretations.
Yes.
It would be good if you sort of...
It's another reading.
Another reading. Because I'm really opening, you know, more than one reading towards the end.
Any more questions?
Do you know what date of the poem is? Is it around
I think
the same time as The Ancient Mariner, or is it...
I think 1817, 1779. I forgot.
Is it one of those that appeared early in Sibley?
Maybe I have it here.
1817, or sort of lyrical ballads. It'd be quite interesting, I suppose. The other thing I was thinking of with the date is was Falkland. Wasn't Falkland Shelley's great sort of antagonist?
I think there might be a real Falkland that he could be referring to.
If it's a bit later, it might be, as well as the interesting sort of play on words that you're talking about with Falkland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it was 1779. I don't know. He must have written it before Shelley. He's of an older generation, anyway.
But that's interesting, because I was thinking about Godwin's Caleb Williams, because isn't the tyrannical landowner there is Falkland as well? So Falkland, I mean, you know, and Coleridge sure would have known Caleb Williams, must have read Godwin. So, and he has, you know, an antagonist in there called Falkland. So.
All right, thank you.
If there's no more questions, can we thank Professor Elsevier again for...